First, research has found that COVID-19 infection significantly increases the risk of developing diabetes. A study published in the medical journal Lancet last month found that the risk of getting type 2 diabetes increased 40% among those infected with COVID compared with those who didn't get COVID. COVID's also been shown to increase the risk of type 1 diabetes in those under age 18 compared to those who never got COVID. We're talking about this research finding the link between COVID infection and later diabetes diagnosis, especially type 2. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that you've been through yourself? Did you or a loved one develop diabetes after a COVID infection? What questions do you have about the link between COVID and diabetes? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Dawn Belt-Davis is a professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. She's an expert in type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Dr. Davis, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, Dr. Davis, I'd heard a lot about the risks of COVID for people who already had diabetes. That seems like it's been pretty clear for a while. This was news to me, though, that having been through COVID, you have an elevated risk of being diagnosed with diabetes. What do we know about that so far?
Right. Yeah. So you're right. There has been pretty clear evidence from the beginning of the pandemic that patients who have obesity or type 2 diabetes seem to be at increased risk for more severe outcomes related to COVID infection. And what has been emerging now over the last, several months as we compile all the information from the patients who've been infected with COVID over the last 2 years, it's honestly, there's some conflicting data. A vast majority of the studies do seem to support that there is an increased risk of patients developing diabetes after they've had a COVID infection. So we know that while they have their COVID infection and they're in the hospital, they definitely are at higher risk of having high blood sugars or diabetes. But these are even patients who are now recovered from COVID, more than a month, up to a year or so after their infection. And we're seeing increased rates of diabetes, new diabetes diagnosis during those time periods.
I know type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes, we call it both diabetes. They're both kind of different in their causes, their outcomes. There's some overlapping treatment. Are we seeing elevated risks of both of these kinds of diabetes post-COVID?
Yeah, so that's a great point. So type 2 diabetes is the form of diabetes that we typically think of more in adults. It's associated with obesity and is the most common form of diabetes. And that's where most of the data comes from, is looking at patients who had newly diagnosed diabetes. Most of those were with type 2 diabetes. And, the reasoning behind why we're seeing this increased incidence with COVID infection, we really don't know that answer. There's a lot of theories. We know that the COVID virus itself can actually infect the cells within your body, the beta cells that make insulin. So it could be a direct damage to those insulin producing cells. We also know that with infection, there's increased amounts of these inflammatory signals and stress hormones that can worsen diabetes or lead to diabetes. But there's some other interesting, ideas too. One is that a lot of patients may not have had good access to medical care or not having frequent medical care. And then after their COVID infection, they come in for more medical care and may have been diagnosed with diabetes that could have possibly even been there before their diagnosis. And this is an important point because we know that if you look across the board, about 20% of the people who have diabetes are actually undiagnosed. They don't even realize they have it. So possibly some of these signals we're seeing could actually just be from patients having more medical care and getting diagnosed. And then the last important point is that we know that COVID infection has hit certain populations harder than others, particularly in this country. And some of those populations do have higher risk factors for diabetes due to social determinants of health, things like lower socioeconomic status, less access to high quality food, less access to the ability to exercise. And so, again, comparing apples to oranges, sometimes we might see an increased rate of diabetes in these patients that may be explained by something other than the infection. So it's complicated. And then briefly to touch on the type 1 diabetes story, type 1 diabetes is caused by autoimmune disease, and it happens usually in children or young adults. And in this case, we know that type 1 diabetes sometimes is triggered by a virus infection. And so there's a possible link there with the COVID virus and type 1 diabetes. But the data there is still emerging, whether there's truly an increased rate of type 1 or not in patients with COVID infection.
Talking to Dr. Dawn Belt-Davis, professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at UW's School of Medicine, looking at links between COVID-19 and different kinds of diabetes. As we're hearing, a lot of research going on, more still needed. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Dr. Davis, what are you hoping to see? Do you think we should be monitoring people after COVID, watching closely for potential signs of diabetes?
Yeah, I think that certainly the adult population, particularly those who already have risk factors for diabetes, I think absolutely after COVID infection, they should have a little closer monitoring and be screened for diabetes on a more regular basis. In kids, it's a little harder with the type 1 diabetes because, again, we aren't 100% clear on that connection, and we don't routinely screen children for type 1 diabetes either. But certainly if they had other risk factors, it would be important to follow up on that.
And flipping things back around, and the elevated risk for people, as you were saying earlier, who have type 2 diabetes, why did that make them more vulnerable to severe impacts of COVID?
Yeah, and that's a great question, too. I think, those patients tend to have some other things going on at the same time. They often also have high blood pressure, are at higher risk for heart disease and stroke, are more susceptible just to having those very high blood glucose levels during their infection, which can make it harder to treat and manage the infectious process. So sort of a whole bunch of factors that play into that.
In general, for people who have been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, whether it's post-COVID or not, what are the main things they need to do when it comes to treatment and healthy lifestyle?
Yeah, so I think, the number one thing is making sure that we have patients being screened for diabetes and being, diagnosed as soon as possible. When they are diagnosed, managing their diabetes usually involves a combination of things, but medications are often required. It's not necessarily something that you can manage with diet and exercise alone. In some patients with type 2 diabetes, they may even require insulin therapy. And so it's just important to follow up with your healthcare providers and find the right treatment for you. Importantly, we want patients to recognize that diabetes is a disease like everything else, and it needs medical treatment. We don't want patients to feel like that they're necessarily always to blame for their diabetes, and which there's a lot of stigma sometimes around that. So it's important to recognize, get good medical care, do your best on lifestyle changes, but focus on getting the treatment that you need.
Dr. Davis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. That's Dr. Dawn Belt-Davis, professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at UW's School of Medicine. She talked to us about COVID and its link with diabetes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In just a few minutes, we're going to turn to insulin and the cost of insulin, a bill in Congress aimed at reducing the cost. How big a deal is that for you and your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. The U.S. House passed a bill last month that would cap the price of insulin at $35 a month. People with type 1 diabetes need insulin to survive. It can also help people with type 2 control blood sugar and avoid complications like kidney damage and nerve damage. Human Rights Watch earlier this month called unaffordable insulin in the U.S. a human rights abuse. Supporters of the bill say they want to make affordable insulin a reality for the nearly 2 million Americans with type 1 who need it to live. Others who benefit from the therapy would still need to pass in the U.S. Senate to take effect. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you or someone in your family relies on insulin, can you talk about the cost? How affordable, how available is it for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Vincent Rajkumar is a professor at the Mayo Clinic and editor of Nature's Blood Cancer Journal. He's the author of a research paper titled The High Cost of Insulin in the United States and Urgent Call to Action. Dr. Rajkumar, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, starting with this bill, it passed the House, still waiting for action in the Senate. How big a deal would it be for the cost of insulin?
Well, I think it's a small step forward, not a big move, because it covers one drug. It covers copay, which is important to patients, and it caps the copay at $35, as you said, but it doesn't cap the cost of insulin. So if the cost keeps going up and the copay is kept constant, then the premiums and taxes would go up on everyone else. And then finally, it doesn't cover the uninsured and the underinsured, who are the ones paying facing a lot of this burden. About 25% of the insured population will benefit because they are currently paying more than $35 or more for their insulin.
I talked to you about this when your paper that I referenced came out, Dr. Rajkumar. Can you compare and contrast the cost, the price of insulin in the United States with other comparable industrialized countries?
It's a huge difference, and that's what makes it such a big problem. It's the same insulin. It's the same insulin since, the late 90s and 2000s till now. And it cost at least 10 times more in the U.S. for all types of analog insulins than in any of the other developed countries. So the reports are like, you can compare to 30 different countries with benchmark, and we would be insulin costs in the U.S. are 10 times or more higher.
What drives that?
Well, we have a number of issues here. There is no negotiation on the price of insulin, so it's whatever pharmaceutical companies set. There's a monopoly on the product itself, with very few companies controlling most of the market. And then there's a lot of people who benefit in the middle, from wholesalers to pharmacy benefit managers to others, who all benefit from a high price. So it's multiple factors, as I outline in the paper, and it's not an easy solution.
What kind of solutions do you point to try to bring those numbers down?
I think negotiating for the price of insulin and capping the actual list price and lowering the list price would be the main thing, since Medicare Part D covers insulin, and allowing more biosimilars to enter the market so that there's competition would be another second step. Having some transparency in the arrangements between pharmaceutical companies and pharmacy benefit managers in terms of what is causing the difference between the list price and what insurance companies are paying for the product.
You mentioned all those other countries where insulin is way cheaper. Are those factors present there, or is it just a completely different system and it's kind of hard to compare the U.S. with what they're doing?
It's completely different system, because in almost all the developed countries, the government is paying for the cost of these drugs. And so they negotiate not just for insulin. And that's why a solution just for insulin is not enough, because we have the same problem in cancer drugs. We have the same problem in any novel treatments that we bring about, that if we don't negotiate and there is a monopoly, then prices will be very, very high. And they are always higher in the U.S. than in other countries.
Talking to Dr. Vincent Rajkumar, professor at the Mayo Clinic, looking at the price of insulin, a bill in the House aiming to cap the cost to consumers for their monthly insulin supply. But as Dr. Rajkumar says, that means that the cost will go somewhere else. He's looking for more fundamental solutions. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What would you want to see happen to bring down the cost of insulin or other expensive prescription medications? Do you rely on insulin or one of those other very expensive medications? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Rajkumar, I referenced earlier, a lot of people rely on insulin literally to live. Can you talk about what insulin means for people with type 1 diabetes and then type 2 diabetes?
Sure. Insulin is critical for our survival. Type 1 diabetics, and I think there's more than a million type 1 diabetics, 1 to 2 million type 1 diabetics in the U.S., they did nothing wrong. They just developed this autoimmune type disorder, and the cells that make insulin in the pancreas don't exist. So they need insulin for survival, and without insulin, they will die. And so it's for nothing that they did wrong. Now for their whole lives, they have to rely on insulin. And it's really important that we don't penalize them for a disease that they didn't have any control over. So for them, it's life or death. And so they will buy it no matter how expensive it is. And that's something that we have to keep in mind, that there is a product which is so important for survival that if you have a monopoly over that, then it does cause a problem. For millions of other Americans who have type 2 diabetes, insulin is still very important. And some people point out, oh, there's obesity or there's other things that you can control. Yes, but there are many, many people who need insulin to live a long life. If you don't treat the diabetes now, then we will pay extra to take care of the heart disease or any other problems that follow downstream. So insulin means a lot. It's a hormone we all need for survival. And we should try to make it affordable, just like it is in all other developed countries.
Now, given that this is a market, Dr. Rajkumar, I would imagine if it's a case where only a few companies are selling insulin at a high cost, another company, if I were another pharmaceutical company, I'd want to get in on it, undercut them a little bit, take some of this high demand market from them. Why doesn't it play out that way?
So some factors. One is that companies which own these analog insulins, like Sanofi, Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, they keep filing newer and newer patents on the same insulin, which trying to prolong the patent life and preventing competition from entering. Secondly, insulin is a hormone, so you cannot just make a generic. The analog insulin companies would have who want to enter the market would have to convince the FDA that they have a biosimilar that is exactly similar in bio, in how it works to the parent compound. And that is a more difficult process than getting a generic drug approved, which is just a chemical, and you can show that it's the identical chemical. So it's a harder process. So biosimilars have been late to come in. And naturally, because it's a biosimilar, only big pharma is making it. So some of the biosimilars we have on the market are also made by big pharma, and they also want to make money.
You've used the phrase analog insulin. What, and I've heard that elsewhere. What does that mean?
So the normal human insulin that we make in the pancreas is extremely good. But one of the best things that happened in the late 90s, 2000s was the analog insulin, which actually worked even better than human insulin, which when given externally to diabetics. Analog insulins have a more predictable time of action, a more predictable duration of action. And so most of the modern insulins that people use now are analog insulins. They're not exactly identical to the human insulin that we make in the pancreas.
How long have we had insulin as a medication?
Insulin's been around since 1921, but we have always made modifications to insulin. So it was the first, the beef insulin, then the porcine insulin, then the human insulin, and then the analog insulin. So every few decades, there's been a modification, and every modification meant new patents, and slowly that translated into higher cost.
Could somebody patent, I don't know, like, or produce an old school insulin, the stuff we were using 20, 30 years ago, and maybe it's not quite as good as this analog insulin, but it's still maybe life-saving?
It's still available. You know, the so-called Walmart insulin is Humulin. It's the human insulin. It's not analog insulin. It has some disadvantages. So for an insulin-dependent diabetic, it would change their lifestyle. You know, they would have to be monitored multiple times a day. They could get high and low blood sugars much more frequently. And so it's not fair to patients when we have products on the market for 22 years and 25 years that we tell them use the products that were around 40 years ago.
Do you have hopes that companies are going to get some of these different analog insulins on the market anytime soon that will help bring the price down?
Yeah, there are a couple of biosimilars already on the market. Now, the madness is there is that, you know, even say Eli Lilly is making what is called an authorized generic, which is taking their same insulin, putting a different label on it and selling it at a half price. You may ask then, why would somebody buy the full price version? People do buy it because, like I said, there's a lot of people who profit in the middle from a higher cost product. So, but that the existence of an authorized generic made by the same company that's making the parent compound and selling that at half price tells you what's wrong with our system.
Briefly, Dr. Rajkumar, what is your best hope for something that's going to happen in the next maybe few years to bring down the price of insulin for those who depend on it, just in our last minute or so?
I think insulin is the Achilles heel of the pharmaceutical industry because it's been around for 20 years and there's no, you know, it's a novel drug, therefore it's expensive argument. If we can solve, but we should use insulin as the face of the problem and then make enact a change in that would affect all prescription drugs. Not to take away profits from any company, not to take away innovation. I work with pharmaceutical companies closely. I work on new drugs. I understand their importance, but it has to be fair. Medicare should be able to negotiate for the price of the drug based on the value it provides, just like other countries do.
Dr. Rajkumar, thanks again for joining us today. Dr. Vincent Rajkumar is a professor at the Mayo Clinic, editor of Nature's Blood Cancer Journal. He talked to us about the cost of insulin in the United States as Congress works on a bill to at least lower what insured consumers pay.